From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I'm going to say that I don't have bitterness in my heart. I do. You know, I'm very upset and angry with what they did to me. I mean, I just don't, am not going to let that bitterness control me. But it's strengthened my bitterness that I've had towards the government for the genocide, the Holocaust that they've committed against my people.
Leonard Peltier is once again denied parole. Today, part two of our interview with the Native American leader from Leavenworth Penitentiary. And Assad is buried. A look at the late Syrian president. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Nearly 50 years to the week since the start of the Korean War, the leaders of the North and South met this morning for a first-ever series of talks. The three-day summit started with a surprise welcome by North Korean leader Kim Jong-il at the airport on the outskirts of Pyongyang, where his southern counterpart, President Kim Dae-jung, arrived to an elaborate reception. The two leaders then rode in the same limousine into the North Korean capital, where an estimated 600,000 people lined block after block of broad avenues, waving bouquets of pink paper flowers. Spectators appeared to direct their emotion at Kim Jong-il, whose name they chanted in unison as the motorcade passed through the city of 2 million. This is the first meeting between the heads of the two Koreas since they were divided following World War II. Analysts have said the summit offers the greatest hope for peace on the Korean Peninsula in more than 50 years. Reunification is the stated goal of both nations and is considered at the top of the agenda in the talks. The leaders will also discuss the North's missile and nuclear programs and the 37,000 U.S. troops deployed in the South. The U.S. military presence is being met with escalating protest in the South. Syria's new leader, Bashar Assad, met today with Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and vowed to pursue the same policies toward Israel established by his late father. Albright arrived in Syria in late morning and went straight to the presidential palace, where she viewed the closed casket bearing the remains of Hafez al-Assad, who ruled Syria for 30 years before his death on Saturday. This news from the New York Times. Investigators at Los Alamos National Laboratory have discovered that computer hard drives containing nuclear weapons data and other highly sensitive material stored in a vault at the laboratory have disappeared. This according to government officials. The hard drives were stored inside a vault and locked containers in the X division of the National Laboratory, where nuclear weapons are designed. They were reported missing on May 31st by officials who were inspecting the facilities after the forest fire in the Los Alamos, New Mexico area, Energy Department officials said. While the containers were still in the vault, the hard drives were gone. The hard drives contained what officials describe as data used by the government's Nuclear Emergency Search Team, or NEST, a unit that responds to nuclear accidents and nuclear-related threats from terrorists. The data on the hard drives includes all the information on American nuclear weapons that the team needs to render the nuclear devices safe in emergencies, according to officials. Among the missing material was intelligence information concerning the Russian nuclear weapons program. Officials are uncertain whether the data has been misplaced or stolen. It was also unclear whether the loss of the data would have any effect on the NEST team's ability to do its job. An ethnic Albanian language newspaper temporarily banned by Kosovo's chief UN administrator reappeared today carrying the same article that led to the ban, a piece the United Nations says contributed to the murder of a Serb employee. It also said it would continue publishing similar articles and accused unnamed international officials of theft and involvement in prostitution. The Dita Daily, published by a man who used to be an advisor to Kosovo Albanian leader Hashim Thaci, accused a Serb UN translator in April of membership in a Serb military unit that beat, robbed, and expelled its neighbors during the crackdown on ethnic Albanians. 2 weeks later, he was found stabbed to death. This news from Bridgeport, Connecticut. The Boy Scouts of America has filed a federal lawsuit claiming the group was removed from a list of charities eligible for state parole deductions because of its stance on gays. Boy Scouts lawyer George Davidson said the selective targeting of the Boy Scouts for exclusion based on their dislike of Boy Scouts' message is unconstitutional. The State Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities unanimously ruled last month the Boy Scouts cannot be included among payroll deduction charities since its policy against gays violates state discrimination laws. And Bruce Springsteen performed a new song about the New York City police killing of Amadou Diallo to a New York City crowd yesterday, despite angry police union leaders urging their members to boycott his concert. The New Jersey rocker made no introduction and offered no explanation of his thoughts on the song American Skin. 41 shots. After Springsteen debuted the song in a June 4th Atlanta concert, State Fraternal Order of Police President Bob Lucente called the rock icon a dirtbag and a floating fag, while the president of another police group called for a boycott of Springsteen shows. The words to the song, 41 shots, 41 shots, 41 shots. Across this bloody river to the other side, 41 shots they cut through the night. You're kneeling over his body in the vestibule, praying for his life. Is it a gun? Is it a knife? Is it a wallet? This is your life. It ain't no secret. It ain't no secret. Ain't no secret, my friend. You can get killed just for living in your American skin. Bruce Springsteen singing 41 shots. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The body of the late Syrian president, Hafez al-Assad, was borne through vast crowds of mourners today aboard a gun carriage with his son and successor Bashar following behind. A double line of troops kept crowds back as the fleet of black limousines containing the new leadership followed the coffin, which was resting on an artillery piece towed by a truck full of soldiers. Bashar, still with no official government title but headed for the presidency after a referendum expected in July, led the mourners walking behind the coffin. Also visible was his younger brother, Maher, Assad's younger brother, Jamal, and government officials, including the defense minister and armed forces chief. Conspicuously absent at the start of the funeral was Vice President Abdel Halim Khaddam, who legally assumed the powers of acting president on Assad's death last Saturday, but had not been seen in public since. We're joined right now by two people to talk about the president and the succession of power. Our guests are Nicholas Blanford of the Daily Star of Lebanon, Lebanon's only English-language daily, and Lisa Wadeen. She is author of the book Ambiguities of Domination, Politics, Rhetoric, and Symbols in Contemporary Syria. She's an assistant professor at the University of Chicago. Lisa Wadeen, can you talk about the significance of the death of the Syrian president?
Well, obviously it engenders a certain kind of apprehension and also a certain kind of hope for stability in the Middle East. Assad has won a certain kind of grudging public acceptance over time, if not popular adulation. And he was a ruler who was known to bring a measure of calm to what was a fractious Syrian political scene. There is growing apprehension that with his death, his son will not be able to secure the same sort of political stability. I think, like in the United States, people have been largely willing to opt for safety over or democratic fulfillment.
Nicholas Blanford of the Daily Star of Lebanon, what is the response in Lebanon? And also, if you can explain why it's so significant in Lebanon who the Syrian president is.
Well, the Syrians have a very important role in Lebanon. They are the dominant power broker.
Are you speaking on a speakerphone?
No, I'm speaking on my cellular.
Okay, if you could.
Can you not hear me?
Yes, I can. Just speak as loud as you can.
Okay. The Syrians have had a fundamental influence on Lebanon since 1990, at the end of the Lebanon 16-year civil war. They control certainly every facet of Lebanese foreign policy, particularly in regard to the peace process with Israel, but they also have very strong economic and political ties. The reaction, I think, in Lebanon to the death of President Hafez al-Assad It's been one of a wait-and-see attitude. I think this is probably true of the whole region. But there has been, over the last 3 or 4 months, a rising tide of body of opinion in Lebanon that is calling for a removal of around 25,000 Syrian soldiers who have been in Lebanon in a greater or lesser extent since 1976.
Let's talk about the succession of power. Laysa Wadeen, Bashar, the son of the Syrian president, taking power. But also, what about the brother and who is he? And the significance of the vice president not being at the head of the funeral.
Okay, in regards to Bashar, you know, obviously he was not the person that was initially primed to succeed his father. It was the other son, Basil, who died unexpectedly in a car accident in 1994. So Bashar had a crash course in politics over the last 6 years. He's the next oldest son. He was summoned home from London, where he'd lived for 2 years. He's basically an ophthalmologist without the kind of political background that his older brother had experienced. Having said that, you know, he has had a crash course in the last 6 years. He's somebody who is known or has slowly built a reputation for being some of what his father is not, that is to say, accessible, open, worldly in a way that his father was not. I don't know whether he has the kind of political acumen to maintain power. He's perhaps known as Syria's only public advocate of computer literacy and the Internet, and I think people do expect that the economy will open up with Bashar's rule, were he to be able to secure power. Now, that's a big question. To some extent, that will depend on whom his advisors are or how quickly he can co-opt as many important key people as possible. Now, the threat of the other brother, Rifat Assad, who's 63, taking power, is a real threat, and there are folks in high-ranking officials in the PLO and high-ranking State Department officials who anticipate that Rifat will attempt to carry out a coup, and indeed Rifat on Monday suggested similarly that he did intend to challenge the Bashar's right to rule. He was quoted in El Hayat, of course, it wasn't El Hayat. He was quoted in El Hayat at the Daily, quoted an unidentified Syrian senior official as saying orders had been issued to arrest Rifat should he show up in the country. And that suggests that the transition, it wouldn't be as smooth as some people have hoped it would be.
And Rifat, again, the brother of the late
president. The younger brother, 63 years old, who has attempted, actually, to take power before in 1984 and was subsequently exiled.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the late president, Hafez al-Assad. His history, Laysa Wadeen.
He came to power in 1970 in a bloodless coup that was entitled the Corrective Movement. He had been an army officer prior and a member of the Ba'ath Party. He has brought a measure of stability to the country hitherto unknown. For example, in 1949, there were 3 coups alone in Syria. During Assad's reign, there has been a measure of stability, but also at certain costs. There has been a ruthlessness to his rule. And what's also true, I think, is the main problem in Syria is that years of one-party, one-man rule have sapped the country's energies almost totally, so that there is a kind of lack of democratic participation, a lack of political vitality in the country. In 82, there was the massacre at Hama that basically crushed a would-be rebellion when Syria was arguably teetering on the precipice of civil war. And in 1984, Rifat Assad's brother attempted to take power and was subsequently exiled. Since 84, most opposition has been of a more kind of individual or artistic nature. That opposition is relevant insofar as one can see in cartoons, jokes, things like that. But there's been very little organized political opposition since 84, 85.
Laysa Wadeen, you mentioned Hama, massacre. And I don't want to just go past that without you describing what happened.
Well, it's hard to say exactly what happened. Estimates range from anywhere from 5,000 to 20,000 people, I tend to sort of support a kind of 10,000 figure, were killed in this massacre. Arguably, the regime was teetering on the precipice of civil war. There was an Islamicist movement in Hama, about seven different sorts of guerrilla organizations in Hama that had stockpiled weapons and were primed to challenge the regime's primacy. And it was actually Rifat's troops that crushed this uprising in Hama in 1982. It was the most significant of the uprisings, but there had been previous challenges to Assad's rule from Islamicist groups in other major cities, and there had also been assassinations of key Alawi folks, not necessarily people identified with the regime, but the Alawis are a minority sect that are about 11-12% of the population.
This is Assad's sect.
And this is Assad's sect. But having said that, it's not accurate to say that, you know, Syria is ruled by an Alawi couple for two reasons. The first reason is because the Alawis themselves don't necessarily always get along. They don't operate as a unified group. And second of all, the regime has promoted a number of nationalist policies. Delivering electricity to the remotest parts of the countryside, national education, those sorts of things that have not been in any way discriminatory against non-Alawis.
You're saying that the Syrian military in 1982 massacred 5 to 20,000 people?
I would guess it was somewhere around 10,000 people.
Mm-hmm. And what was the response within Syria?
Well, there was a significant number of people who tried to get out of Syria who were identified with those groups, and basically the rest of the folks generally tended to lay low and to stop in any way acting politically in public. It became too dangerous, obviously, to act politically in public. There were other challenges later on, little ones here and there, but for the most part, people became extremely quiescent and tired.
Nicholas Blanford, this history that Lisa Wadeen, author of Ambiguities of Domination, Politics, Rhetoric, and Symbolism in Contemporary Syria, has just laid out in Syria, how does it parallel, or does it, Syria's control in Lebanon? Are you still there, Nicholas Blanford? Well, that was Nicholas Blanford. We were talking to before of the Daily Star of Lebanon, the only English daily. Lisa Wadeen, in the last minutes that we have left, yes. You have a very interesting book, Ambiguities of Domination, where you talk about how the population deals with repression and the inability to speak out. Can you describe Syria today?
Syria today is, in terms of the book looked at all the rhetorical practices and imagery that substituted for discussion of substantive political issues in public. And I asked, you know, why bother with rituals of obeisance that are transparently phony? No one thinks he's the country's premier pharmacist, or that he's going to live forever, or that he wins elections by 99.8% of the vote. And so I make the argument that these forms, these patently spurious slogans and imagery, actually operate as a disciplinary device, that they enforce obedience, that they induce complicity, that they structure the terms within which a certain kind of resistance can take place, that they atomize people from one another, because I know that you know that he's not the first pharmacist, but I don't. What you do think, at least in public, we're having to evaluate each other through an enforced prism of popular dissimulation. And it tires people out. It takes things that were politically meaningful and it makes them seem vapid or meaningless. It's depoliticizing. And I think that depoliticization has been extremely important to the regime's ability to rule. Having said that, I should also say that Syrians recognize the cult as a disciplinary device and also try to work the weaknesses of the system to subvert these mechanisms of social control in a variety of ways. That doesn't mean that opposition is collective, but it does mean that through tolerated and underground parodies, jokes, films, etc., people do attempt to subvert mechanisms of daily control. And it shows that Syrians are not fooled by the rhetoric of flattery. Assad is still feared and disliked enough so that beneath the surface there is a simmering contest between ruler and ruled. And this is kind of fought out on a quotidian basis between the regime and the party on the one hand and most of civil society on the other. And that, I think, suggests that no one knows how long the Ba'ath dictatorship can continue to operate or how genuinely a successor regime such as Bashar's can remain in power.
Lisa Wadeen, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Her book is called Ambiguities of Domination, Politics, Rhetoric, and Symbols in Contemporary Syria. It's published by the University of Chicago Press.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. And you're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll be airing the second part of a interview with Leonard Peltier from Leavenworth Penitentiary. Yesterday, the parole examiner recommended he be denied parole once again. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Leonard Peltier was denied parole again yesterday. The Native American leader is serving two life sentences for the murders of two FBI agents. Peltier says he did not kill the agents. He's already served more than 24 years in prison. The parole examiner recommended that Peltier's sentence be continued until his next full parole hearing in the year 2008. The U.S. Parole Commission will review the recommendation and make a final decision. Peltier's attorneys said yesterday the decision would be appealed. We're joined right now by one of those attorneys, Jennifer Harbury. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jennifer.
Thank you, Amy. Good to talk to you.
Well, it's good to have you with us. People may know you much more from your work around Guatemala and repression there, as well as the murder of your husband, Everardo, in Guatemala. How come you've gotten involved in Leonard Peltier's case?
Well, in a lot of ways, it struck me as very similar to what had happened to my husband in Guatemala. Once again, we have a intelligence network, this time inside of the operating inside of the United States instead of internationally. We once again have a targeted Native American or indigenous population. And, of course, the combination leads to the end result of severe repression and unlawful activities taken against that Native or indigenous population. So I found the case hauntingly similar to my husband's.
Describe what happened yesterday at the parole hearing. Where does it take place, first of all?
It took place in Leavenworth Prison. We brought 10,000 letters of support that have been written in the last 3 months alone, asking that Mr. Peltier be given his immediate freedom. We also brought stacks of letters from Nobel Peace Prize laureates around the world, the largest church networks, both domestically and internationally, prestigious human rights organizations from across the United States, the European Union, et cetera, et cetera. We brought five work release programs together with housing offers from all over the United States, including one from Canada. We brought in Native American leadership, old friends, a representative of the National Council of Churches, who is, of course, the Reverend Yasutake, a Japanese-American Episcopal priest who was interned as a U.S. citizen back during World War II. He's now the head or the director of the Interfaith League of Political Prisoners. And we brought in a representative of Amnesty International. We also presented a two-page list of Leonard Peltier's remarkable humanitarian work from behind bars during the last many years. That includes establishing a prisoner art program for inmates, working on the Rosenberg Fund for Children Advisory Board, establishing a Native American youth scholarship program, assisting in planning special medical care programs to assist the people of Pine Ridge, Working on an annual Christmas and clothing drive for the people of Pine Ridge, donating art for sobriety and drug-free programs for Native American people. You name it, he's done it from behind bars. Even with those incredible limitations, he's managed to do all of these things. Before we even finished and before the hearing officer had read the rather frightening medical letter prepared by a physician affiliated with Physicians for Human Rights, before the hearing officer had read that letter and read all of the other materials that we presented, he simply said, I'm not giving you parole. And the real reason, Amy, that is so disturbing in this case is they will not give him parole until he admits or confesses that he killed the two agents. In other words, unless he confesses to something he did not do, unless he confesses to a crime he did not commit. And a more serious violation of the United States Constitution is difficult to imagine. This man is way overdue for parole. He has now served longer than most prisoners convicted of the same or similar crimes and longer than the amount of years recommended by justice regulations.
Can you explain that, Jennifer Harbury? He was convicted of two murders of FBI agents for the killing on the Pine Ridge Reservation June 26, 1975. Explain how he would have been eligible for parole by now.
Well, parole eligibility is based on a number of factors established by Justice Department regulations, you know, like the number of years he was sentenced to, the certain percentages, and so on and so forth. It's a simple arithmetical equation. And then the parole board looks at good behavior, medical condition, is he a threat to society, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
What we are most perturbed about, though, is that this man has never received a fair trial. Witness in his extradition from Canada has admitted that she never met him and did not witness the killing, and that the only reason she signed that affidavit is that FBI agents threatened to take her children away and in general terrorized her. The three witnesses on the stand were 15 years old, contradicted their original statements to the grand jury and other persons, contradicted each other and contradicted it themselves, and later admitted that they too had been heavily coerced. Two out of the three are now dead. They were dead before they were 25. The FBI ballistics expert had said that he could not perform the most precise ballistic test on the gun alleged to be Mr. Peltier and the bullet casing found near the bodies. Later, under the Freedom of Information Act, they found that that test had been performed and that the bullet could not have come from that rifle claimed to belong to Mr. Peltier. It literally says not compatible, different firing pin. They had hidden that test from the defense and from the jury during his trial. And lastly, they radically changed the description of the vehicle. The two young agents had chased a red pickup truck onto the ranch, and a shootout had broken out between the red pickup truck and the agents' unmarked cars. This was in the middle, of course, of the Reign of Terror, in which 64 Native Americans who were members or supporters of the American Indian Movement had been murdered, and also others had been terrorized, harassed, beaten, and intimidated by the vigilante groups that were working very closely with the FBI. They had, in fact, in one instance, received armor-piercing ammunition from the FBI, as well as other forms of collaboration. So when the shootout started, everyone shot back. After the shootout, after the killing of the agents, the FBI always said they were looking for a red pickup truck. At the trial of the other two defendants, it was a red pickup truck. By the time they came to Leonard's trial, which was their last chance to put someone in prison who happened to be an AIM leader that was on the ranch that day, they had a problem because Leonard Peltier did not have a red pickup truck. So they changed the description to an orange and white van and said that they chased Leonard onto the ranch and that he lured them into an ambush, then placed the gun to their heads and shot them at point-blank range. In fact, no evidence of that exists in the record anywhere, and the United States prosecutor has since then on many occasions admitted that nobody knows who killed those agents. He was denied a new trial under very strict technical grounds, saying with the judges saying that they could not give a new trial because he had not proven with a certainty that had the ballistic test and all that other information been available to the jury, that they would have ruled differently. And the judge has since admitted if it had been, could have ruled differently or would, might probably have ruled differently, the result would have been different. But they felt he had not proven that with a certainty. The same judge, Heaney, has since written to Senator Inouye asking that Leonard Peltier be given clemency, saying that the United States acted with improper military force at Wounded Knee, setting into action a long chain of reactions that eventually resulted in that firefight, that the government had to share responsibility for those tragic results, and that Mr. Peltier should be set free.
We're talking to Jennifer Harbury, who is one of the lawyers now for Leonard Peltier, in prison for more than 24 years. She was at the parole hearing yesterday at the Leavenworth prison. Can you explain how, at the conclusion of Leonard Peltier's trial, the prosecutor wrapped up by saying, "We proved he went down to the bodies and executed those two young men at point-blank range." But then at an appellate hearing, the same attorney, I believe this was Lynn Crux, conceded, "We had a murder. We had numerous shooters. We do not know who specifically fired what killing shots. We do not know, quote unquote, who shot the agents."
Well, that is exactly, those two statements are the crux of what so many people, you know, from Nobel laureates to European Union to National Council of Churches and so on and so forth, Amnesty International, that is the crux of our civil rights and human rights complaint. At the trial, Mr. Crooks and the prosecutors literally ended up their whole presentation with exactly the quote that you gave. Mr. Peltier is the one that walked up with that rifle and shot those poor agents through the head at point-blank range. Then, of course, the ballistic test was finally discovered that shows that that bullet did not come from his rifle. The witness testimonies become completely discredited. Those poor young teenage witnesses had literally been picked up again and again by federal agents. They'd been tied to chairs. They'd been threatened with beatings. They'd been told they would never see their families again, that they would spend their lives in prison. And they finally broke under that kind of pressure. So their credibility for their testimonies has gone down to about zero. And at worst, they did not see Mr. Peltier pull the trigger, even at the worst parts of their testimonies. And then, of course, there's the radical change in the vehicle and the extradition based on a completely fabricated affidavit. That's what led the closing argument statements about how he definitely is the one that pulled the trigger. Then confronted with their own misconduct, their own fabrication, their own obstruction of justice, they were forced to turn around 180 degrees and admit that they don't know who pulled the trigger. So the big question is, why can Leonard Peltier, years overdue for parole, model prisoner, humanitarian worker 20 hours a day from behind bars and in deteriorating health, why is it that he is not allowed to leave the prison walls unless he admits to a crime that even the prosecutor admits they don't know who committed? Why must he confess guilt for something that he did not do? And I think the answer is, we have the Waco proceedings going on. We have the Geronimo Pratt, the very parallel case of the Black Panther leader recently released from prison after 27 years, after FBI misconduct in his case was finally disclosed. He, of course, has recently won a $4.5 million lawsuit over exactly that misconduct. And I think that the FBI does not want now all of the disclosures and publicity and revelations that would come about what was basically a massacre of Native American people on Pine Ridge Reservation with their heavy collaboration back then.
Can President Clinton grant executive clemency to Leonard Peltier?
Of course he can, with a swipe of the pen.
The number that the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee is giving out is the Justice Department number. However people feel about the case, since the parole hearing was yesterday, we encourage people to call in to let their voices be heard. And we got these comments yesterday as we gave out the number of the Justice Department public comment line.
This is David Gidley out on the West Coast. I wanted to phone Washington, D.C. to protest about Leonard Peltier, and I'm pretty sure I wrote down the number, 202-305-1400, but it's a disconnected number. I suppose I could try you again if someone wanted to just give me that correct number, or I'm not sure exactly how I go about it. So otherwise, I'll try to phone you tomorrow. Thank you very much for the wonderful reporting you do. It's just exceedingly appropriate and excellent program. I'm just very, very grateful for it.
Well, that was one comment that we got, and we couldn't understand because we'd given out the number. We had checked the number, and we did give out the number of the Justice Department public comment line. And then we got an idea of what had happened from the next caller.
Hi, Amy. This is Deborah Scott in Houston, and I was calling regarding the free Leonard Peltier show that you ran this morning. This is Monday the 12th. I did call Janet Reno's office this morning and voiced my opinion, and my son called this afternoon, and the number 202-305-1400 has been disconnected and is no longer taking calls. So I did some tracking, and they have switched to another comment line, but that information is not forwarded on this 1400 number. So it again, just appears like more of a conspiracy to quelch public comment. And I'm just outraged about it, and I just thought you could do something about it if anybody could. Thanks so much for your work. I really appreciate your show.
We have checked out a new number for the Justice Department if people want to call in. Jennifer Harbury, is this common that they just cut off their comment line and actually disconnect it when they're getting a lot of calls?
No, I don't think it's common, but I really want to thank everyone out there that to your show, and of course I want to thank you too, Amy, for all of your coverage on difficult and controversial issues like this.
Well, we've just checked out a new line. We figure if you just call the Justice Department, the general number, that's a real person who answers, and you can ask to be connected to the comment line, or you can just give your comment to the person who answers. The Justice Department general number, we don't think they can disconnect this, is 202-514-2000. That's 202-514-2000. But really, Jennifer Harbury, what difference would it make if someone called in now? The recommendation came down yesterday from the parole examiner that Peltier's sentence be continued until his next full parole hearing in 2008. Would it make any difference now?
Yes, because that decision is not final until it goes to the Washington, D.C.-based United States Parole Commission. Those people, in turn, are, you know, in one way or the other, under the indirect supervision of Janet Reno herself as head of the Justice Department. So there still is room here for action, and there must be. I just would like to close with saying that I saw a real nightmare situation yesterday of a Native American leader who was literally lynched through FBI misconduct, denied an appeal under a very arbitrary and overstrict reading of a technical legal standard, left to rot in prison, who then became more than eligible for parole. He is a stellar prisoner, a human rights leader from behind bars, and he was told, because you've been ruled guilty, we know you're guilty, we will not let you out because your story about your innocence does not square with what the courts have ruled about you based on FBI-tainted evidence. That's what we heard yesterday. They did not even want to read his medical report because they don't care.
What's President Clinton's comment been on the Leonard Peltier case? Is it true this is the longest clemency consideration in history?
Extraordinary. Extraordinary. Those are usually ruled on very quickly. This one has been pending for years with no decision.
Since 1993. What has Clinton made a comment on the case?
No, very much as in my husband's case years ago, we're suddenly getting these statements about how we can't meet with anyone and we can't make any statements because it's a legal proceeding. That is simply not true.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Jennifer Harbury, part of the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee, speaking to us from Kansas, where she just attended the parole hearing for Leonard Peltier. If you want to get more information on the Peltier case, Jennifer, where can people go?
Call the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee National Office in Lawrence, Kansas, 785-842-5774.
That's 785-842-5774. Thank you.
It was the worst outbreak of violence on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation since the 71-day siege at Wounded Knee 2 years ago. Police sources said the agents may have survived the initial gunfire, only to be executed later. Then there was another heavy exchange of fire. One Indian was shot dead. The rest of the Indians escaped.
A people pray to freedom as freedom cries. A man waits in a cage. A man calls to justice, but justice lies in the dream of the living. Lies change, genocide remains.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, part two of the interview with Native American leader Leonard Peltier from prison. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman.
My name is Leonard Peltier. I'm a Lakota and Chippewa Native American from the state of North Dakota. I am currently serving two life sentences for the deaths of two FBI agents in Leavenworth, United States Penitentiary.
Did you kill the FBI agents?
No, I did not.
Leonard Peltier, in the interview that we played yesterday from Leavenworth Prison. Today we are going to bring you part two. Yesterday he described what happened on the reservation on June 26, 1975, when two people who later turned out to be FBI agents came on to the reservation, ultimately were killed along with another man, a Native American named Joe Stultz. This is a continuation of the interview with Leonard Peltier from Leavenworth Prison. Back to that day on June 26, 1975, the day of the shootout. I went to the website noparolepeltier.com, and they say the shootout, with one side firing only 5 times and the other over 125 times, was unbalanced at best. With all the shooting and danger to the women and children in the, quote, crossfire, it's obvious that the AIM people were the ones doing all the shooting. The agents' ability to defend themselves and shoot back was quickly neutralized. And it says autopsy and crime scene results indicated that in all likelihood, Agent Kohler had received an initial and debilitating injury. He was able to return fire with one round from a service revolver, one round from a 12-gauge shotgun, and one round from a .308 rifle. He had apparently, while standing at the open trunk of his vehicle, received a wound from a bullet that passed through the trunk lid, severing his arm. His ability to function at that point was limited. He may have begun to go into shock, leaving Agent Williams to defend them both and call for help. It goes on and then says none of the bullet wounds received by Agents Kohler and Williams were at that point fatal. However, they then received fatal wounds to the head from a high-powered rifle at contact range. What is your response?
Well, my response to this is that, again, here we go with the FBI and their outright lies. I mean, if they had only fired 5 shots, why was the Jumping Bull House and a couple of little houses surrounding it completely destroyed by gunfire? I mean, there was tear gas canisters stuck, very large bullets that were stuck on the side, because this was a log house that had stucco on the side, and it was very hard to penetrate. And there was hundreds upon hundreds of bullet holes, all riddled. These homes are riddled with bullet holes.
Did that happen
Who
then?
Who the hell did that?
Did that happen then or later?
I don't know. I mean, they were surrounded. We were surrounded by 250 cops shooting constantly.
How did you get out?
Well, we got out to help grace of help of the Great Spirit. Apparently, if we were guilty, the Great Spirit would have not let us get out of there. You know, That's how we got out.
What kind of campaign has the FBI waged against you during this period, this quarter of a century that you've been imprisoned?
Well, they've certainly spent a lot of money, which I'm sure they're not taking out of their own pocket. They tried to stop In the Spirit of Crazy Horse by Peter Matheson with a $49 million lawsuit. They tried to destroy Peter Matheson for telling the truth in the Spirit of Crazy Horse. That's a multi-million dollar campaign just on that issue right there. They did not want...
This call is from a federal prison.
They did not want In the Spirit of Crazy Horse published. They wanted to silence it so that it couldn't get out there and tell the people what really happened. And this is one thing I want people to read, is read In the Spirit of Crazy Horse. Peter Matheson researched the thing for years before he put this book together. And that's just one incident that they've done for me. I mean, this is the most highest sued book in the history of American literature. They tried to destroy, they threatened Robert Redford. Told Robert Redford that if he made the movie about me, you know, he says, you're a very big celebrity, you know, and there's a lot of criminals out there who would like to kidnap some of your children. And if you did something like this to make this movie and help get Peltier out, he says, there's going to be some of our agents that's going to feel animosity to you. And they probably won't do the thorough investigation to try to save your kids. Robert said, I got the message, and he never made the movie. And of course, today they're out there on the internet. They're out there.
Who said that to Robert Redford?
FBI agents. This is what he tells me. So, I mean,
you mean a full dramatic movie as opposed to the documentary that he narrated,
yes,
Incident at Oglala?
Well, after what he finally said after years, of course, when he did make the Incident at Oglala, my children are grown and they're out and got their own families and they're secure. The security's well taken care of, and I'm just not going to live under their threat no more. And I'm going to go ahead. He financed Incident at Oglala himself. He used his own money on that, because he felt so, felt so bad about what happened. He said, I'm not going to live under the threat the rest of my life. I want to correct an injustice, and then I'm going to do this, and it's what he made in Incidental Law.
I'm talking to Leonard Peltier, who is speaking to us from Leavenworth Prison in Kansas. Can you describe the scene right now where you are, Leonard?
Well, I'm in an area, a little cubicle, about 5 feet wide and 5 feet, about 5 feet square. And it's open, and there's a lot of noise out there, and above the cell block. And,
how long have you been at Leavenworth?
I've been at Leavenworth since June 29th, 1985. Before that, I was in Marion, Illinois since my incarceration began.
What has life been like behind bars for the last quarter of a century? What has it done to you?
Personally?
Yes.
Well, I hope it hasn't done anything. I mean, I don't really feel different. I mean, in the sense that I'm angry and filled with hate, although I admit I do have some. I'm very upset with what they did with me, and I would like to see justice in that area. I hope I've grown into a stronger person, more intelligent person. But we all do that with age, so maybe that's just...
In part one of the interview we ran on Democracy Now! Yesterday, Peltier talked about the 60, more than 60 Native Americans who had been killed on the Pine Ridge Reservation just before the killing of the FBI agents on June 26th. And what is your assessment of the media coverage of you and your case?
Well, I get a little frustrated with it. I mean, you know, again, they want to concentrate on the FBI agents, which is, I have nothing to hide, and I answer the questions. But they want to keep saying it to harp on the deaths of two white people. Hey, I mean, it frustrates me so much. I mean, what? They must think of us less than human beings. I mean, you know, and then their shows are generally slanted more towards the governments, the FBI. They won't mention the legal issues, constitutional violations that I won in 1985. You know, where the judge found there was withholding of exculpatory evidence, which means if I had that evidence, I would have been exonerated from it.
And that evidence was?
The ballistics on the most critical evidence against me, the murder weapon.
And explain it one more time.
Well, they claimed this weapon was the murder weapon, and this was the weapon that killed the agents at close range, et cetera, et cetera. But they couldn't do a firing pin test on it because it was severely damaged. Well, they did do a firing pin test on it, and it came out negative, but they withheld out that evidence. And
so they knew the gun that you were using.
They knew it, right. You know, I have no way to know if this is the murder weapon or not. How the hell do I know? You know, I'm sitting, we don't have no way.
This call is from a federal prison.
And FBI misconduct, perjury by government witnesses. And the judge erred in his rulings for preventing me from putting up a defense. I mean, those are the constitutional issues.
Will the Supreme Court hear your case?
No, the Supreme Court denied certiorari on every time we filed an appeal.
What recourse do you feel you have now?
Well, for right now, it looks like just clemency. But the 25 years are up now, this month. And under the new FOI files, the FBI can no longer continue to hold those 6,000 documents that they have claimed under reasons of national security. They couldn't release. They said they couldn't release them because of national security. And they got over 6,000 documents. Hopefully, I can get that now this year. And there's got to be something in there to help me. I mean, if there was anything that was detrimental to me or harming to me, they would have turned it over a long time ago.
What do you most expect to find in those documents that the FBI has kept?
Well, somebody gave the orders for Myrtle Porter Bear. You know, somebody gave the orders for the ballistics. Somebody gave, whatever. I mean, somebody was given the orders for that. I'm sure it's not with just field agents doing, making sole decisions. And I'm sure there's other evidence of why they were there, why those agents were there in the first place. What was the big buildup of all the armed personnel carriers around the reservation after Wounded Knee, after 1973? I mean, what was such high mobilization of FBI agents?
What has your imprisonment meant for the movement, the Native American movement in this country?
Well, it's kept Indian issues alive for 24 years. It's kept them very alive. My case has been a forefront in Indian issues throughout this country. I'm not tooting my own horn when I say this, but right now I'm the only Indian that's ever had over 150 tribes sign resolutions requesting clemency for me. And it's even growing. It's even higher than that now. But two of the major, most powerful Indian organizations, and one here in the United States, one in Canada, the National Congress of American Indians here in the United States, and Assembly of First Nations in Canada have committed themselves to do everything they can to get me out of prison.
How is your health, Leonard?
Well, I got diabetes. I got a little heart tumor. I mean, not tumor, but irregularity. I got high blood pressure. My jaw, I just had it operated on at the Mayo Clinic. I believe it was in April or March. And I'm able to move my jaw now. And the pain that I was experiencing on my right side because of the fall-ups they made in operations at Springfield in 96 is no longer there. And, it's not normal yet, but it's at least I got movement. And I hope that's all that's wrong with me. I mean, I hope there's nothing else.
What has it meant for you to grow old, though you are not that old, but to grow, to be in prison for 25 years?
What has it meant to me?
Yes. How has it affected you?
Well, again, I mean, you know, I'm not going to say that I don't have bitterness in my heart, and I do. I'm very upset and angry with what they did to me. I mean, I just don't. I'm not going to let that bitterness control me. Mm-hmm. But it's strengthened my bitterness that I've had towards the government for the genocide and the Holocaust that they've committed against my people. And you know, I hope I'm a better man than I ever was. I hope that.
Do you have thoughts about who gets imprisoned in this country? And also, though you are not on death row, who gets put on death row?
Well, sure, just the poor people. People that can't afford a good attorneys. People that, you know, look at DuPont. Killed this guy over there. He's never went to any prison. I don't think he was ever went to trial. I never heard about it. But, you know, we got people in there like Mumia. Poor people that can't afford good attorneys.
What does people's support around the country and around the world mean to you?
It means that a lot of people are aware that the United States government is not the great democracy that it claims to be. Listen, they're going to shut me off. You want me to try it again? If not, I guess it'll be over.
Any last words, Leonard Peltier, you'd like to share with our listeners? And are you familiar with Democracy Now?
Yes, I am. I listen to you as often as I can. Love your program.
And as usual, as happened about every 10 or 15 minutes in the interview, we were cut off. But he did call back, Leonard Peltier, with this last word.
I'm not going to give up. I'm going to keep fighting. I'm not guilty. And I'm going to continue to say that the rest of my life, and I'm going to continue to fight for my freedom. And if I can't, you know, while I'm fighting for my freedom, I'm going to continue to fight for my people's freedom.
Leonard Peltier, speaking to us from Leavenworth Prison in Kansas. He has been imprisoned for 24 years. And again, if you want to voice your opinion on his case, you can call the Justice Department at 202-514-2000. That's 202-514-2000.
Held in bondage. The people pray to freedom as freedom cries. A man waits in a cage. A man calls to justice, but justice lies in the dream of the living. Lies change, genocide remains.
And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. The music you've just been listening to from the documentary about Leonard Peltier called Incident at Oglala. Democracy Now! Is produced by David Love and Jeremy Scahill. Our engineers today, Anthony Sloan and Matthew Finch. Errol Maitland's our technical director. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address, democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman, with special thanks to Robert Knight for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!